where Jerry made an observation this spring, and that's about the size of it for Footprint Creek. We've moved over into adjacent drainage basins and have instrumented these basins rather heavily, and we're trying to figure out exactly what is going on in nature to try and establish a norm. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Llewellyn. I think we'll all agree that Mr. Llewellyn has given us an excellent example of the research opportunity that arises from man's disturbance of the permafrost. I have been advocating that in the case of the pipeline, that what we need to do in Alaska is zone the area that's required for the pipeline, let the companies go ahead and develop the pipeline, and then we'll have a tremendous research example that the scientists will be observing for the next 100 years. Maybe we might even tax the pipeline to support the research. It'd be a wonderful idea of getting a great deal of research done and of having a somewhat controlled experiment. We know what the temperature of the oil going through the pipeline, the research on the heat distribution of that oil. I can see that there'd be a tremendous experiment that could be set up that maybe the scientists could benefit from the development. Are there any questions for Mr. Llewellyn? Any questions? Again, thank you very much. The last paper on our schedule is by Dr. Max C. Brewer, the director of the Naval Arctic Research Laboratory. And the title of his paper is Road and Airstrip Construction in Arctic Alaska and Its Effects on the Permafrost. Mr. Brewer.
Thank you, Dr. Quam. I think that we all owe Bob Llewellyn a very good vote of thanks, because by bringing up some of the problems in connection with construction or the lack thereof, he has made it possible for us to go to lunch earlier. The subject of construction of airstrips and roads in Arctic Alaska is basically one problem, because after all, an airstrip in many respects is nothing but an overly wide road, and hence they can be treated simultaneously. There are effectively three big problems in the construction of either roads or airstrips, and these are: one, permafrost; two, seasonal frost; and three, erosion. Some of the difficulties in the connection with construction has been a failure to separate out the effects of the permafrost, seasonal frost, and erosion. For instance, we talk about frost heave, and basically this is not a permafrost problem. This is a problem of seasonal frost. And to discuss it as an integral aspect of the permafrost problem, except in very rare instance, is adding confusion to an already confused problem. In order to be able to discuss something you have to sort of identify the players and what positions they play. Permafrost is often maligned largely because it is assumed to have a standard and definable set of physical properties, and hence if you touch permafrost in one place, study it a moment, then you should have the criteria for construction in all areas having permafrost. This has been a problem. And over the years, many design failures, as well as much over-design of facility, has resulted from this erroneous assumption. Permafrost, although defined as a material having a temperature below freezing for two or more years, might, from an engineering approach, more reasonably be considered to describe a condition of being rather than a material. Perhaps this is where some of the problems have arisen. We find that permafrost on the north slope of Alaska is cold, and I'm happy that Bob brought up some idea of warm and cold. Although in his discussion of thermal erosion, I was afraid for a moment he was going to give the impression that we were dumping hot water on the tundra, and after all, temperature is only a relative degree, and I think that some of his hot water that he was eroding with might have felt awfully nippy if you were to take a swim in it. But the permafrost in northern Alaska is cold permafrost. Generally, having a temperature at a depth of very little seasonal change of some -6 to -9 centigrade, although in the same area, in the barrel area, depending on what point we want to prove, we can find permafrost with a temperature of -1.2 or -10.7. Some people might say that it depends on which group that you're discussing the problem with. But there is a great deal of variation. We come down towards the mountains, the Brooks Range, and find that the permafrost temperature warms up a bit to -6 or -7. Come on south of the range in the Bettles area, -2. In Fairbanks, much of the permafrost is right on the freezing point. You look at it crosswise, and the thing will go ahead and melt on you. And yet, you continue on further south, down the Copper River country, and again, we have temperatures of -2, and so that we can say that in many respects, permafrost in the Copper River area is somewhat similar to that in the Bettles area. The active layer, the zone of annual freezing and thawing above the permafrost, also varies markedly in both depth on the north slope, any place from 8 to 54 inches, depending on the material, the drainage available to it. Whereas in the Tanana Valley, we can have 8 to 120 inches of thaw. The factors, some accumulative, others not, affecting the temperature of permafrost may be considered as follows. Air temperature, although actually air temperature is a difficult thing to work with, we should have the temperature 1 centimeter below the surface of the ground, and this would give us a much more accurate parameter. Moisture content of the active layer, including ponded water. Moisture content of permafrost. Surface cover. thickness of organic mat present, snow depth and density, the micro relief, by that I mean the polygons, and I'm talking about something on the order of 2 or 3 feet, the topography, these latter two affect the drainage and erosion, material and grain size, and wind. Here we have 10 factors that affect permafrost. And in any discussion of them, unless you can say that the 10 factors are the same for different areas, then it's very difficult to describe the conditions of permafrost as necessarily being the same in these areas. It rapidly becomes apparent that neither permafrost conditions nor the effect of construction in permafrost areas can be assumed to have much in common, except for a tendency for the material to be very water rich and to be below freezing, by definition, over wide areas. As a result, only the area commonly referred to as the North Slope will be discussed today, although I'll show a slide or two further south. For example, although 4 to 4.5 feet of fill has proven satisfactory for roads and airstrips along the North Coast, approximately 16 feet of fill would be required in the Glen Allen area to provide the same protection for permafrost there. From what we have said here, it becomes obvious that empirical interpretation of the resulting influence of these factors must be made if construction projects are to move forward. On the other hand, as we apply these empirical interpretations, we should always keep in mind what some of the factors are. I think if we start now, we can show some of the problems a little bit more graphically. And again, I want to thank Bob for giving me a very fine lead-in. First slide, please. This is an area showing the showing what is called termed low center polygons, and these are typical along the North Coast. In each of these ditches or troughs, we can find an ice wedge 4 to 12 feet wide and extending down any place from 10 to 15 feet. Next, please. This is a close-up of a high center polygonal area. And this is basically an area showing erosional remnants, as Bob so effectively pointed out in his slide. Again, an ice wedge in each of the troughs. And it's the natural erosion of these ice wedges that is giving me a polygonal pattern. Next, please. This is one that is back inland in the gently rolling country, showing the tussocks, and for all intents and purposes, no polygons. Yet if you were to provide construction over this area or dig into it, you would find the same ice wedges that were showing in the other photos. Next, please. Could you sharpen on the focus there? This is a cut along the river showing how the ice wedges extend down into the area, and this is a sideways view of one of the wedges. Next, please. Sharpen. Will that show a little better? Here we have road construction in which the tundra has been scraped up from both sides to provide a berm with the thought of putting gravel over the top of it. And it gives a road in which the canals during the first year are not sufficiently deep enough for boating and are not sufficiently deep to allow ducks or geese to nest and have safety from predators. Meanwhile, the traffic continues off to the side. Next, please. This, on the other hand, is a road constructed with gravel, approximately 5 feet of fill, and this road will provide trafficability the year round. In addition, from the standpoint of economics, the snow will blow clear from this road, and so that it requires very little maintenance either winter or summer. Next, please. This is a photo of a road constructed where you have rolling country, some relief. One of the things to observe in the past photo is that it was constructed on the flats. Therefore, erosion was not the tremendous problem that we see in this particular area. There is very little that can be done with this area in the line of repair because it is hard to revegetate or repair something that is on the move. Next, please. This is the close-up of the same road. Next, please. And this is a little closer up. There was Bob's weasel before it had coat of paint. This is in the Umiat area on the north slope. Next, please. This is a view of natural erosion, and had Bob let me see his slides earlier, I wouldn't have tried to compete with him. Next, please. Man-made erosion on a somewhat larger scale. Next, please. Again, could we sharpen that, please? Here, in an attempt to go ahead to properly add fill for construction, and on the other hand, showing a little bit of man-made erosion. Next, please. And the glass slides. Could we sharpen, please? Trying to bring out the lake country in the north on the coastal plain. Basically, in that area, we need one type of road construction. As we move into the foothills, a different type, and then the Bettles area that I was discussing, the Tanana Valley, and down in the Copper River. But here we're talking about an area of approximately 800 miles in north-south general direction. And for that reason, I have been talking about construction on the north slope, because to talk about road construction in the Glen Ellen area as compared to the north slope, even though they have this condition of permafrost, actually is about as sensible as discussing the roads in Seattle all in the same breath. Next, please. This is a road again constructed on a flat area without much danger from erosion, showing the problem when insufficient gravel is used to provide insulation that is as effective as the original organic mat, which with the surcharge of gravel has been compressed and is probably less than 1 inch thick. The beauty of these roads is that you never have a speeding problem. Next, please. This is just along the side, showing here the effect of surcharge, how it is pushing down and changing the ecology right adjacent to the road. Next, please. This is the road up on the hill. We actually gave this the name Alligator Road in the early days. The differential settlement in 2 years amounted to 12 feet. Next, please. Now, this is a graph showing what actually happens temperature-wise in the permafrost. This is in a undisturbed area, and at the top we show the sine curve temperature with time, and these are for air temperatures, including 1951, which I've always claimed was the coldest winter at Barrow. It happened to be the first one that I put in. But here we see the temperature at 10, 21, and 30 feet, and how the sine wave continues on through with the asymmetry here and the freezing. And this is caused by the fact that the permafrost, or the temperature of the permafrost, cannot decrease until after the active layer is completely frozen. Next, please. This is a slide showing the temperature under various thicknesses of fill. The thickness, or the depth here, is 5 feet beneath the original surface, and in one case we have tundra, in the second case 7/10 of a foot of gravel. This was a case where they shorted us a little bit, and it shows then 1 foot, it should have been 3 feet, and 5 feet of gravel. This slide is the formed the basis of the design for the roads and airstrips in the western third of the dew line, and also some of the recent roads and airstrips. There are several items here, and this is where the parameters come in. These pads were adjacent and to one another, and the condition on the original tundra was that it had approximately the same amount of snow on it. There was not much difference on the 7/10 of a foot of fill, about the same snow cover. By the time we got up to 3 feet of fill, we had less snow cover, and virtually no snow cover on the 5 feet of fill. And so, although we're taking adjacent areas, adding fill, the effect at depth is virtually nil, because as we added the gravel, we unintentionally had less snow over it. There is also the suggestion there that in the case of the tundra, there was no compression of the organic mat. Next, please. This is a time temperature curve in the Alligator Road area, showing that when we remove the organic mat, what we're doing is removing the insulation, and that insulation is a moderating influence, much as a marine plant. So that when you take the organic mat off, the stripped area tends to get colder in the winter time than does the unstripped area. And then in the summer, it will warm up. Now, the amount of heat lost in the winter time is sufficiently great that if you also measure the temperature at a depth that is uninfluenced by the thaw, you'll find that it is also colder. Next, please. This is a section under the road at Glen Allen, showing again time temperature curves. And we find that in the winter time, I don't know if this will sharpen up a little bit, but in the winter time, the coldest spot beneath the road, this is at a depth of 10 feet, is beneath the center line of the road, even though that may have 5 feet of fill on it, and you would assume that it would be well insulated. However, since cars are using it, it is they attempt to keep it free of snow, and so we lose the effect there, showing the interaction of these factors. The next coldest area, of course, is under the right shoulder. The warmest area is not in the undisturbed material, such as you would suspect, but it is in the ditch. And the squirrels have known this for many, many years and have always dug their burrows into the bank, because that is where the snow will drift, providing them with the maximum of insulation. Next, please. And I think this is about the one calling for lunchtime. Here again, time temperature curves at various depths in the Glen Allen area, 5 feet and at 15 feet in the beneath the center line and in undisturbed ground, showing that here in the beneath the road itself that you have the greatest change in temperature, because this is now in the active layer, thawing and freezing each year. Here again we see a comparison of temperatures in permafrost, and if we compare them with those that we saw in the original slide for Barrow, we see that to design as though it were all one item, even though we call it permafrost, could lead us to very disastrous results. Lights, please.
Thank you, Mr. Brewer. Are there any questions for Mr. Brewer? I want to thank the members of the session for adhering to the time schedule so well. We seem to have come out just about right in time. I think if we ran over, it was because of the coffee break. So I thank you, thank the audience, and we'll go on to lunch.